So, Alan, Dave Weiner here, May 30th, 2020. There is no right way to approach this, and to talk about outline development for software, I mean, there's the way I do it today and the way Frontier does it, and they're different. I think the more significant by far is Frontier, and it's what I keep trying to get back to with JavaScript. And so far, haven't been able to do it, as I mentioned in the email. And with all the sort of problems that I've brought to you as sort of an expert on JavaScript over the years. So what I figured was, after giving it a bunch of thought, the best way to do this is to tell the story about from the point of view of how I got introduced to Frontier. And it was an iterative process. Like everything I do, I start out with an idea, and then I do some development on it, and then I put it down for a little while I work on another idea, and then get to a good stopping point with that, and I work on yet another idea. And I'm sort of following my intuition, saying, well, I know I'm going to need this, and I know I'm going to need this, and this. And these are sort of the basic ingredients, how I build the basic ingredients for whatever it is that I'm making. And it's been my process ever since I started programming in, I guess it was 1977, something like that. And what was interesting, so this work started in 1988, the work on Frontier. And what was interesting was that I had no code base at that point. I had sold my company, Living Video Text, to Symantec, and had left the company with a severance package and a non-compete agreement, and also a covenant not to hire any of my former employees for 2 years. And so I had, 1988 to 1990, where I couldn't compete with my former company, and I also couldn't hire any of the programmers that I like to work with, which is who I would have hired. And so I had 2 years to work on my own, and this is what I wanted to do. I had been, a software executive. I never stopped being a developer. I had like two jobs. But I wanted to go back to full time. And this time I wanted to do it on the Mac. While the company had been developing on the Mac, I had never myself done it. So I wanted to learn how to program on the Mac. And then I wanted to make, I had a very specific idea. It was a thing called Betty. That was the basic idea. And Betty, so what was Betty? Betty was less than what Frontier turned out to be. And it was an outliner and a programming language. And the programming language could control the outliner the same way, let's say, Lotus 1-2-3's macro language could control the spreadsheet and also the file system, because the idea was at the time that the Mac could really benefit from having a scripting system, because it had, the best graphic user interface, really the only graphic user interface at the time. Windows was still languishing in a pre-3.0 situation. It was not very competitive. And so, but here we had this wonderful thing, the graphic interface. It's how I made the product that eventually allowed me to be successful in making software. And so I loved that, but I also loved the ability to, write shell scripts. I mean, because I came from Unix. Before I ever got into personal computers, I was programming on Unix and C. And I had to go all the way back there. I had done an outliner that was good for editing Pascal code. And that was actually how I got into outliners in the first place, is I wanted to make tools for programmers. So I'm coming back around in... This is 10 years after I started programming, and I'd been through all this, you know, startup mode, software author, CEO, whatever, all this stuff. And I just wanted to get back to programming with now all that I knew. And, you know, of course, the machines are much more powerful. The Mac 2 has, I was working on a Mac 2. It had a lot more memory. It had a lot more screen power. It was just a much more powerful computer. Anyway, so the first thing I made when I got my freedom was I made an outliner, because I knew whatever I did, I was going to have an outliner in it. And the second thing I did was I created a very low-level database based on Knuth's boundary tag method. It's in his, I think it's volume one of Art of Computer Programming. And it's the kind of database structure that you could use for really anything. You could use it for, you know, for a tree, for a relational database. I didn't know what I was going to use it for, but I knew that I was going to need to do storage, and so I built that. And then the third thing I did was I got a copy of a thing called Mac Yacc, Y-A-C-C, and I'm sure you know exactly what that is. And there was also a lexical scanner that, I forget the name of that one, you know, might have been Mac Lex or something. It was I designed my own programming language, and it just had, you know, the basic, it had the features of, it was Algol-like C, I had features from C, features from Pascal, and then eventually some features that didn't exist in either language because of the environment that I was in had capabilities that C and Pascal had never encountered. And as far as I know, still has never encountered. So I had these three components. And so the first, and the thing was, is I'm going to integrate them. I'm going to create connections between these three components, and I'm going to use them to build a virtual environment, a virtual machine that that runs on the Macintosh, but of course will run wherever I want it to run, ultimately. And though we already knew how to do machine portable code because we had done that at Living Video Text. We had products running on the Apple II, on the IBM PC, and on the Macintosh. And we weren't rewriting code, or at least we weren't rewriting all of it. The connection between the outliner and the language was something, was the connection I knew the most about because I had already done it. And the idea there is that the programs have structure, you know, they're hierarchies. Outlines are incredible, they're hierarchy editors. And so you just say, okay, I don't need curly braces and I don't need semicolons because to do a the equivalent of a left curly brace, right curly brace, I just indent a level, and then to start a new syntactic line, I just press return and start a new line. The headlines in an outline are wrap. So if you make a very long line, it will just wrap around. Now, it's not really easy to read program code like that, but it's enough so that you don't need semicolons. There's no reason to ever tell the compiler that you started a new unit, program unit. However, the way it worked was really low-tech. There was a separate pass at the beginning where it took the outline and it added the semicolons and it added the curly braces because the language needed those. The grammar for the language included curly braces and semicolons. And, you know, that approach, well, it seemed a little risky at the time. Is this really going to work? But, you know, what is it, 88 to 2020? I'm still using that interpreter. I mean, I still use Frontier, or the equivalent of Frontier, the OPML editor, which is another distribution of Frontier. I use it every day. Whenever I do my to-do list for the software that I'm working on, which is, you know, something I work in all the time every day, and then the JavaScript code that I edit, that's also done in the outliner, and And whatever code I write that runs in Frontier is going through that very same parser that I wrote in 1988. Still there, still running. So that was first. And then second was, okay, I've got this database. How am I going to use this database? And so I defined what I call tables, what Frontier calls tables. Other languages call them dictionaries, or JavaScript calls them objects. It's a very common, I mean, Mohsen Alghozain, who worked, was one of the four guys that worked on XMLRPC, he discovered this. This is something I hadn't discovered up to that point myself, which is that every language has the equivalent of what I call tables or objects or, you know, dictionaries. There's a lot of different names for them. Every language has that, and every language has arrays. And those are the two structures. You may find there are a few others. Closures, for example, are different. But anyway, so I had tables. And a table could contain scalars, strings, numbers, floating point numbers, booleans. Let me get it up here. Let me just make sure I'm giving you all the different types. There's the list. Boolean, character, number, floating point, date, direction, string, enumerator, file specifier, alias, object specifier, address. Address is a big one. I left that one out. Object specifier is something that came from AppleScript, from Apple. They decided, they built their own little world that was honestly very small compared to Frontier, but anyway. And then so when we embraced that, we brought their types in too. There are some others in here as well. And then there, so I mapped that onto the boundary tag database, the Knuth, method. And basically each block in the database held a table. And there was a root table in each file. Databases, 32-bit address, actually 31-bit, because that's how boundary tag works. So I think it meant that databases could be 2 gigabytes, which at the time was very big. And there was a root table, and there was a pointer to that root table in the header for the file. And then tables could contain other tables. This is a very big deal, right? And so that's how you build out a hierarchy of data. And it's disk-based. And, so then that's there. And then I also, you see, now I don't know which order to give you I'm just going to give them to you in any order. I'm going to trust you later to sort of put it all together, and then we'll think about all the different connections that are there, because they're all there. There could also be types that were outline, script, menu bar. There were others too. I'm just going to make this window smaller so I can be sure I'm seeing everything here. Yes. And binary. Yes, you could have binary objects. So you could have, obviously you know what binary means. It means anything, really. Yes. Table, picture, outline, script, menu bar, and WP text. We also included a word processor in there so people could edit. Didn't end up using that a whole lot. Outlines are better. I mean, they just are. But, always hedging the bet a little bit. Maybe some people, we're getting this deep into it, but we still are preparing for people who don't like outlines. To get this far, they had to love outlines, basically. All right, so then, now there's, how do we connect the database and the outline and the language. And they do get connected. Well, the outline, for one thing, I think you can see the database is hierarchic, right? So you use the outliner to browse and edit the database. And you do. That's how it works. Turns out it's pretty nice. By the way, this is the runtime environment is totally defined in terms of this database. And what's nice about having a really nice browser for the database and all the runtime data of whatever scripts are running, whatever code is running, is that you can open up a table and watch the values change. I mean, it was like, that was, you know, I call this clean living in program design. Is like, you get to the point, it says, well, you know, I think I probably could make that live update. And then it's like five lines of code to do it. You know you've been doing something right when you get to that place. And that is what it was like. And so it does. So you have the outliner. You browse through it. You can edit it using the outliner. And, okay, so that's the connection between the outliner and the database. And also you could put outlines in the database, of course, as I mentioned before. Scripts are also outlines. This is just a class system, right? So the base type is outline, and then their script is an outline plus code that's linked to it, into it. There is a compiler in here. That's what the Yak thing is for. It generates parse trees, and that's what the runtime runs on. It never generates machine code. It just, you know, it's the program counter is a pointer into a tree of the parse code, and you know, the code executes, it moves the... You understand how these things work. You've built languages, of course, right? And now the question of how does the language access the database? Now, the default way to do that is you would have a set of routines for accessing elements of the database, and you would load them into memory of the code that's running, you would operate on them, and then you would just save them out, right? I mean, that's how it works in every language. But and those routines are here, that you could do it that way. However, there's a much better way to do it, which is every one of these objects in the tables have, you know, it's a name value pair. Everyone is it's got a name and a value, and the name can be an identifier in the language. Even if it's not, you could still refer to it in the language. And so you got the root table, right? We already talked about that. You got a subtable in there. Here, let me give you an idea of what are the subtables of the root table. Wait. Let's go to, yeah, opml.root, right? Wow, there's a lot of crap in, oh, I see what's going on. Well, there are a few items, I'll just read them off. Examples, scratchpad, suites, system, user, websites, workspace. Of those, only suites and system have significance in terms of the system. The others are things that we defined as part of the culture as we moved on. And in fact, even suites doesn't have any special meaning. It's all in the system table, basically. The system table is where you put code that's executed at certain times. You put callbacks in for things that modify the built-in functionality, user interface designs, all the data that the compiler maintains. It's got, you know, linkages to all of the built-in verbs. It's got a section called language, which has the constants. You know, it doesn't have the constants built into the language itself. It's built into the database. And you could modify, for example, you could change the name of infinity if you want, but you couldn't really change it because it would just reset the next time you boot. But you can also view them, which is really nice. All the internal tables, all the internal data is linked into the object database structure, so you can view it. Even the keywords for the language are here. An object type is token. Isn't that interesting? I forgot about that. The stack is visible through the database. Semaphores. You can view all the different threads that are running. See, we don't, it is a multi-threaded environment. All the files that are open, you can go, there's a table there that has all those in it. I mean, we arrived at a level of, once we got the script editor, the outliner, which was the script editor and the database editor and the menu bar editor, once we had all that built and the object database was debugged and the language was topped off and completed, then we spent years developing in the actual environment itself. Because this was the goal, actually, at the beginning of, you know, in 1988, if you'd asked me, what's the goal? What are you trying to do here? I would have said, I'm going to make the language that I'm going to spend the rest of my career in. That was what I was trying to do. It was based on everything that I knew about languages and data and applications and users and what do I need to create a really good lab for creating new technology for people? And that's what I was aiming to do. And so once we got to the topping off place, and really that was 1990, I'm going to say 1990, you know, maybe 91, sometime in there. Then we worked on building functionality into it that enhanced the Macintosh operating system. And actually, it was a division of labor. I passed off all the kernel, everything I've described so far, we call the kernel. And I passed off the kernel development to Doug Barron, who's a guy, now my, you know, covenant not to hire programmers from, or employees, had expired. First guy I hired was Doug Barron. Doug was a guy who worked for me at Living Video Text. He was one of the lead developers on our products. You know, we rotated through them. People would stay. They were sort of like, well, he was a programmer, but a showrunner. And I could talk to you about how we worked together, but I hired Doug in and I delegated to Doug the workings of the kernel. And I moved up to the next layer, which is I'm going to write applications in this environment that we created. And there were a lot of applications developed. Continued the development process that was defined by the process that led to the runtime. Which, by the way, I think the thing Smalltalk had a runtime. It didn't generate applications to run in the Unix environment. I'm assuming that it had a higher level, a platform, the equivalent of our object database or something like that. And I don't know, I would be interested to hear a very similar description to what I've just given you of Frontier. I'd be interested to hear the same thing about Smalltalk. And I also know that HyperCard was the same kind of philosophy. It was a different, completely different priorities from Frontier. But a similar architecture, a new language, editing environment, and a runtime. And the runtime was not the runtime for the Macintosh operating system. It ran on the Mac, but it wasn't a Mac system. If you want to really do a holistic job of this stuff and not just make part of a tool chain, this is what you have to do. Yields something really great, and you can't get it out of this, what we're doing right now. You can't, I mean, the process that the rest of the world is doing, it's very incremental, but it's also very limited because I can build things that enhance the runtime of JavaScript, but I can't really do any integration with the language itself. Yeah. And this is something, I keep hoping at some point I'll convince you to really take this problem on with me and figure out if it could be done with JavaScript as it is right now, and if it can't be done. I never did explain how the language interfaces with the database, did I? I'll come back to that. Well, why don't we go there right now? So you have the root table, and root is implied. You don't actually have to say root.x.y. You can just say x.y, and it will assume that it's root. There's also a paths table. Let's see if I can find that. I wonder where that is. System.paths. Interesting. Now root isn't in here. Root is that implicit. Root is at the top of everything, and it would be path zero if it was there. In other words, you don't ever have to say root.x.y. You could just say x.y. And so if you say x.y.z inside of code that's running in Frontier, it looks at the top level of the object database for something called x. And because there's a dot there, it better be a table, right? And then it looks for a table called y, and then it looks for an object called z inside of that table. And then, you know, that's the value that's generated. If you put the address symbol, the at sign in front of it, it generates the address of that thing. The address isn't a operating system. It isn't a machine address. It's a address, an object database address. You can also have locals too, by the way. Not everything has to be. Now, the thing about the object database is that while things are cached in memory, everything that exists in object database world is persistent. You don't have to do anything to read it or write it. You just refer to it. And if it's not in memory before your code continues, this is why it's, you know, synchronous, because my God, there's just so much built on the fact that it's synchronous. It's like, it's a complete weird world that we live in JavaScript, where you just have to do special programming for synchronicity. You know, you just say x.y.z. If y has never been referenced before, it pauses. You give up the processor so another thread can run, reads it in from the database, puts it in the cache, returns, and then wakes you up returning the value to you. And then if you change it, it's marked as dirty in the table that contains it, and it schedules a save. And that save happens the next time there's a little bit of idle time. So yeah, there's a little lag in there where you could lose data. In practice, it never happens. I mean, it's an incredibly robust database. Databases I did before this one, and I did quite a few, we would end up with corrupt databases. We had thousands and thousands of installations of Frontier, and this just simply was never a problem. You know, corrupt databases, we were prepared for it, but it just never happened. It's weird. Maybe we just got lucky. I don't know. I mentioned the menu bar. I should mention in passing that if you look at a hierarchical menu, an outliner is a really good editor for that. And so there is another instance of an outline that is called a menu bar type, and it's wired into, well, various different places menus can appear. And one of them is at the top of the screen, and it's live. So if you make a change to a line of text at the top level, that will change the name of the menu. Its subordinate will change the name of element in that menu, and then you can have, you know, submenus. And then we went and did menu sharing, where if Frontier is in residence and another application uses the menu sharing protocol, it means that you can add commands to its menu bar. And and because many of the Mac apps were scriptable, that meant you could literally add commands to the application, and it's hot, it's while it's running. It was really beautiful. This is part of the philosophy of the Mac, is that you really do go the extra mile. people don't have to relaunch things in order to get things to be active. It's a very sort of, it's a different philosophy from Unix's. And menu sharing eventually really took off when Netscape supported it. There was this one guy, Alex Tudyk, who worked on the Macintosh product at Netscape. He loved menu sharing, and it was very easy to adapt, so he just put it in. And then it's like a lot of other things. Is once a leading product does something, then you know, a lot of people pick it up. And Netscape was, at the time, that kind of a product. I'm sure I'm leaving a lot of stuff out, because we did work on this at this level, before we moved up to the next levels. We did stick here for 4 years, and it's also part of my philosophy, is I don't like moving on until I feel confident that I'm not going to have to go back and rip up the pavement at the lower level, because I'm such a, you know, so picky about breakage. I don't break people. It's just, you know, if I put something in the environment, I'm never taking it out. And someday, if you want to know, I'll tell you the story that got me there. It was when we shipped our first Macintosh product. It was called, the previous product on the Apple II was called ThinkTank. On the PC, it was called ThinkTank. On the Mac, we called it ThinkTank 128, and it was a product that we did in, like, I don't know, 5 months from beginning to end, because we really wanted to be there. And we were like the second product to ship on the Macintosh, believe it or not. I guess, I don't know. Yeah, if it wasn't second, it was third. And it was very, very early, and we wanted to be very early. And so, you know, as a result, didn't have all the features of ThinkTank on the IBM PC or on the Apple II. And, well, we thought, well, this is a new machine. Nobody will ever notice that, right? Well, no, everybody noticed it. And they were pissed off. They said, you know what, ThinkTank has fewer features here? How could that be? You know, this is supposed to be a better machine. And look, you've had all this time. Why doesn't it have more features? No, those are silly questions, because, I mean, there are technical reasons why they are silly questions, but they're not silly questions because the users don't need to understand that, you know? And I learned that lesson. You know, it could have been solved by not calling it ThinkTank and by giving it another name, but it's just a lot easier just to give them all the features, you know? And that means that you should go slower, a little bit slower when you're doing the development, so because everything you put in, you're committed to forever, basically. Okay, so one more thing, one more sort of idea that I want to talk about is that the philosophy of the development of Frontier continued in the environment itself. And so this is like, well, let me just very quickly summarize what happened. 1992, we shipped the product. I think we charged $395 for it, feeling it was totally justified. It was a very powerful product. Compared to the products that we had shipped a few years earlier, it was vastly more complex. And you know, that turned out to not be the right thing to do. The right thing to do would be to, and I was writing all the checks for the company. I was paying all the employees out of my own bank account. And not a good idea, I have to say, because eventually you feel like, okay, it's time. Let's go make this thing a business. And I had run my previous company. I mean, sure, I put all the money into that for quite a while, but I had no money. By the time I was doing Userland, it was a whole different situation. I had more money personally than my previous company had ever had, because we did an IPO, and in between that, basically all the money that was in the company at a very high multiple, a good portion of that ended up in my bank account, because I didn't get a lot of investors in the first company. So consequently, when we went public, I owned most of the stock. So I had the money and I had burned it, on, you know, doing 4 years worth of development. But it was, you know, I don't have regrets about that because I was building, as I said, the language I'm going to spend the rest of my life working in. But then I wanted to make a business out of it. And this was at a really bad time for that. The Mac had become mature. Windows had become a serious platform. And we were still on the Mac, and Apple had become a bitch. I mean, in the previous instance, they loved us, you know, because we were providing applications for the Mac when the Mac didn't have any applications. And now they didn't love us anymore because, well, they were a much larger company, much more successful. And they felt that we were infringing on their territory, that languages and OS-like things were, you know, that isn't what developers do. That's what we do, you know, which I felt is like, that's not a very useful line to draw because you guys are never going to do anything like this. And the platform fucking needs this, you know. So, but they were being difficult, to be understated. It lasted about a year, year and a half, and Apple just kept fighting us, and we kept trying to adapt to what they wanted us to do, and then they wouldn't live up to the terms that they had agreed to, and there was one final last straw where we had just thrown everything at cooperating with them and trying to make peace with them, and jumped through every hoop they asked us to do, and when they abrogated that deal and, you know, basically promoted all the people we had been working with, but not us. They had a meeting at Macworld Expo of all of the software companies we had been working with, but we weren't invited to the meeting. And that's at the point when I realized we're just never going to get out of this mess. At the same time, software distribution was pricing software at actually zero. I mean, there were people actually paid for the software, but they worked it out so that the distributors made all the money, and that if you were a company like us, like Userland, you would find that all of the co-op marketing money you had to give them to generate demand for your product would totally cover the revenue you generated. And at the end, you would get a check that was like meaningless. It had nothing to do. It wouldn't have even paid for one half of a day for one of the developers that was working at the company. So it was completely diseconomic. And so with a lot of reluctance, I shut the company down and laid everybody off and put everything in, you know, whatever, mothballs, and called it a failure and said it didn't work. And but then I was... how to put it? I was very idle. I was also extremely depressed. And a friend of mine said, you need to go look at this thing called the web. And I was reluctant about it. And then I finally did it. And eventually it just hit me like a explosion. Oh my God, this is incredible. I mean, because networking was something that never really worked very well on the Macintosh, even though, as ridiculous as it was, it had networking built in to every machine, where the PC had it as a complete mess. The Mac had it as a very simple world, but they made the APIs impossible. You could never figure it out. So it wasn't for developers. They kept it for themselves. They made sure that only developers that they loved and supported would be able to do this. That's my take on it. They never were that clear about it, but I was never able to put all the pieces together to actually get any software to work over their network. However, in my very first experiments with HTTP, it was like, wow, this shit is simple. And then somebody sent me an email. So somebody sent me an email, Mason Hale was the guy's name, and he said, you know, I've been using Frontier, and it struck me that this thing would be really good on the web. And this had been bothering me in the back of my mind. It was my intuition too, but I was so jaded by the fact that, you know, I could figure something out, but that didn't mean anybody else would listen. But here was a guy who basically outlined the whole thing, and he was right. I mean, this is the object database and the integrated language, the editing tools. The integration was the big thing, and it worked. It was very web-like thing. I mean, everything about the internals of Frontier, hopefully you can see it, is very Unix-inspired. I mean, I was, you know, if I would belong to any religion in tech, it would be, you know, Dennis Ritchie is Jesus Christ. Because it's nothing unless you have that really clean foundation, and they got that, and they could have gone deeper into the mess that, you know, Multics was becoming, or they could start over and do something really simple. And they really stuck to that. This whole less is more, and worse is better, and you know, small pieces loosely joined. This was another philosophy. It was like the web was Unix's publishing environment, and HTTP was its networking. I mean, I know they had lower-level networking, but HTTP was everything I ever needed or wanted, and it was great. And so that began a development process that started out with the static site generator in, I think it was early, late 1994, early 1995, called AutoWeb. And then after that, the website framework. These are all applications running in the Frontier environment using the object database and all the system verbs that we had for updating file system and shit like that. We edited the HTTP, all the TCP verbs were built into the language eventually. And after after the website framework, I made a suite called the News Site Suite, which was blogging. It wasn't called blogging yet, but and then after that came Manila. And Manila was edit this page, and it was this whole idea that publishing for the web could be really fucking simple. That was the thing I worked on. That was like a year or so. 1999 was when edit this page, when Manila came out. And but the important thing, and then there was more, you know, I mean, after that, you know, RSS, XML RPC, OPML, and lots of things that, you know, those are the things that really took off. There were lots of things that didn't take off, but were also very easy to develop, and were also good ideas. But the point about Frontier was, is that it's still there, and I'm still using it. I use the Outliner in Frontier. I've built a whole new suite. I know I'm like rambling like crazy now, but this is putting, if you're interested in the story so far, at some point I should give you a picture of how I've subsetted what I used to do. So now that it's relevant in the JavaScript world. And it is, I mean, you know, I believe I have better tools than anybody else working in JavaScript. They have tools that do things that mine don't, that I wish mine did. Which is the reason why I switched to JavaScript, but the process didn't stop with the whole kernel environment. It went on into the web, and that line between Frontier and the web, just we attacked it over and over again. Every time we found something that existed in the web world, we found a way to do to make that work inside of our world. And so it became the most highly leveraged, you know, you just didn't have to do a whole lot of work to debug a web application compared to what I have to do with JavaScript. Oh my God. I mean, I didn't mention this, it has an integrated script debugger in there, and it knows how to do things. Again, because it's very high level. This is where I start getting really confused, because the map is so integrated into my head that I don't even have to think about it, which makes it really incredibly difficult to explain it to somebody who doesn't have the map in their head. This all was developed over a period of like 20 years, Alan. So, you know, I had plenty of time to get acclimated to it. But it is something I do want to document. And some of the people who I've talked with from the old frontier community, I've talked with them about it. How are we going to explain? I really would like this to be part of this, if not part of the stack, certainly part of the legacy. But right now it isn't. People just don't have never looked at it. You know, I mean, I like you, Alan, but the things that you say, oh, is this like Frontier? Is this like, no, none of them are even slightly like Frontier. It is far in advance. It was far in advance in the 80s of anything we've got now in 2020. And we did a lot of development after that. So I know that sounds really arrogant, but it's not. It's true. Anyway, I'm going to stop here. 45 minutes is plenty. And you let me know if you like this, if you have any questions. Happy to talk, happy to address anything. I mean, I can imagine this would be horribly confusing. So anyway, talk to you later. Bye-bye.